From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a behind-the-scenes look at the end of the Cold War, we talk with historian Michael Beschloss. He had access to the private communications between George Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev in the years leading up to the end of the Soviet Union's collapse. Beschloss says the two leaders had an unusually secret relationship, and what they said in private often contradicted what they said in public. Also, why is classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviewing a new Elvis Costello album? Well, stay tuned. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has ended his talks in Jerusalem without a Palestinian commitment to return to Middle East peace talks, NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Secretary Christopher did not achieve his stated goal of bringing everyone back to the negotiating table. But at the end of a week-long trip through the Middle East, he seemed optimistic.
I have a very real sense that all the parties want the negotiations to succeed. They want them to resume and succeed at an early date.
The date mentioned informally was the second half of April. Palestinians said they heard some interesting proposals from the secretary, and they will consult with the PLO in Tunis. Both Israelis and Palestinians say they expect consultations to continue over the next few weeks. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin is scheduled to meet President Clinton next month. Observers say that by then, Rabin may make a gesture toward the Palestinians that could bring them back to the peace talks. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney resigned as Conservative Party leader today, apparently in a bid to allow his party to rebuild its popularity before it must call the next election. Mulroney's been head of the Conservative Party for 10 years and Canada's prime minister for 8.5. He said the party will choose his successor at a leadership convention in mid-June and said he expected his successor would call an election in the fall. Mulroney, who's 53, took office with a landslide victory in 1984. His popularity fell during a long recession and with the imposition of a widely unpopular general sales tax. The president of the UN Security Council is expected to summon Iraq's ambassador and warn against threats to U.S. helicopters. On Monday, UN weapons inspectors had to cancel two helicopter flights after Iraqi troops aimed anti-aircraft guns at the craft. Trevor Rowe reports.
The UN helicopter inspections were part of an intensive effort to track down Scud missiles that Iraq is believed to have hidden in violation of the Gulf War ceasefire agreement. Baghdad is believed to illegally possess up to 200 missiles. Monday's incident is the first Iraqi challenge to the UN since the US and its allies launched a series of bombing raids last month after Baghdad threatened Allied aircraft. Rolf Ikeas, the chairman of the UN Special Commission charged with overseeing the destruction of Iraq's weapons, described the incident as being very serious. He said it represented a threat, not just to the crew, but to the overall UN monitoring effort. He said it was necessary to react vigorously, otherwise Baghdad would try to whittle away at existing Security Council demands and erode the UN's ability to carry out future inspections. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 33 points today. This is NPR News. Many defendants who plea bargained their way out of long prison sentences in the savings and loan scandals are reportedly failing to pay their promised fines and restitutions. The Associated Press checked federal court records of the plea bargains and reported that more than 100 defendants have repaid less than a half cent on the dollar of what they owe. According to the AP, they owe more than $133 million. Attorneys for the defendants said that the fines are largely unenforceable because the former SNL executives were often stripped of their assets before their cases got to court. In what he called somewhat bleak testimony, CIA Director James Woolsey told a Senate committee today that North Korea probably has manufactured enough material to produce at least one nuclear weapon. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Director Woolsey said North Korea's plutonium production capabilities are the most serious among a growing number of countries that have or are seeking to obtain nuclear weapons. The International Atomic Energy Agency has demanded inspections of two suspected nuclear waste sites. An examination of these sites would help establish just how much weapons-grade material North Korea has actually produced. But North Korea has refused IAEA demands. Tomorrow, the IAEA board of 35 countries is expected to give North Korea yet another chance by extending the deadline for compliance. Eventually, the IAEA will have to decide whether to turn the matter over to the UN Security Council for action. This is the first time the IAEA has issued such demand inspections, but Woolsey said the leading world powers must keep the pressure up so the IAEA can keep the pressure on North Korea. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
California Governor Pete Wilson has scheduled a news conference within the hour at which he's expected to give the official word that the state's worst drought is over. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We recently witnessed the end of the Cold War. A new book tries to tell us about the events we didn't witness, the closed-door conversations and secret phone calls between Bush and Gorbachev. The book is called At the Highest Levels, The Inside Story of the End of the Cold War. My guest Michael Beschloss is the co-author. Beschloss is a historian who also serves as a political analyst for CNN. He's also the author of The Crisis Years, Kennedy and Khrushchev. When he started the new book in 1989, he expected to write a study of relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. He wasn't expecting the end of the Cold War and the breakup of the Soviet Union.
My co-author Strobe Talbott and I, at the beginning of 1989, talked to a lot of officials in Washington and Moscow and elsewhere with the idea of getting access to private information, contents of summit meetings and telephone calls and telegrams of the like and the like on American-Soviet relations during the next 3 years. But at the beginning of 89, there was no way of telling what the next 3 years would be like. As you remember, in early 1989, George Bush was very reluctant to get engaged with Mikhail Gorbachev. He spent about 6 months on a policy review, and we were almost thinking that we might be writing a book that had an awful lot of blank pages.
You wanted to get access from American and Soviet officials, get access to files, to memos, behind-the-scenes accounts of conversations. What kinds of different reactions did you get from the Soviets and the Americans when you asked for access?
On the Soviet side, this was, as I say, early 1989, and that was really just the beginning of Glasnost. That was a period during which Soviet officials were not very accustomed to talking in great detail with Western authors, and they certainly were not very accustomed to giving access to private meetings and telegrams and notes of KGB meetings and so forth. In a way, they were sort of testing the limits of Glasnost, but for them there was something of a risk because in early 89, it was not so long ago that for a Soviet official to give that kind of information to an American, that person could have made himself subject to espionage. So in those early days, these people were really being quite courageous. On the American side, the American officials with whom we made this arrangement, I think, were mainly motivated by the fact that they felt that the next 3 years were likely to be very historic, and even if we showed them warts and all, as of course we finally did, they felt that they would benefit by having their roles in this very historic period described in a full-blooded way.
You called your book At the Highest Levels because Bush and Gorbachev relied on understandings reached at the highest levels, often in secret or in consultation with their closest advisors. Is there anything unusual in the amount of secrecy in the agreements reached between Bush and Gorbachev?
There is. This was probably the closest and most secretive relationship between an American and Soviet leader for the duration of the Cold War. And there are reasons for that. The book opens in 1987 when George Bush, who was then vice president, was asked by Ronald Reagan to escort Mr. Gorbachev from the White House to Andrews Air Force Base at the end of Gorbachev's first American trip. Bush got in the back of the car and began saying to Gorbachev, "You have to understand, Mr. Gorbachev, that I am not as anti-Soviet as Reagan is. but I've got to operate in a Republican Party that is very skeptical of me, very worried that I'm going to seem soft on communism. I've got to worry, and this is a direct quote, about a series of marginal intellectual thugs around Ronald Reagan who are going to beat me up if I say anything in public that sounds too friendly to you. So I'd like to begin our relationship on this basis, that you and I can say things in secret, just as we're doing now, and not have to say the same things in public. There will be many cases when each of us will benefit politically from saying things in public that are very different from what we're doing in private. That very much set the tone for the rest of that relationship.
Do you know how Gorbachev felt about that?
Gorbachev really was of two minds. On one hand, it made him somewhat skeptical of Bush because he saw it as a sign of weakness that Bush could not say the same thing in public that he could in private. On the other hand, he felt that this would allow him to get certain things from Bush that he might not have gotten out of someone like Ronald Reagan, and Gorbachev exploited that to the hilt.
Well, as you point out, during the 88 election, Bush took a pretty anti-Soviet posture. You say that he did that for political reasons and that he told Gorbachev he was doing that for political reasons, and his campaign pollster Robert Teeter told Bush to play up the Soviet threat. I wonder what you think that says about American politics.
Well, I think it says that oftentimes politicians do not say in public what they say in private, but I think George Bush, from everything that we found in our book, carried this to an extreme. The upside of that is that you can sometimes make agreements that are perhaps for the good of both countries that could not be made if they were revealed to the public. One downside of all this is that if any of the deals that Bush made in secret with Gorbachev were revealed to the public at the time, it could have been very destructive to Bush and his presidency. One case in point. In early 1990, as we show in the book, George Bush had a deal with Mikhail Gorbachev that, despite what Bush might say in public, Bush would not press Gorbachev to give up the Baltic states. Had the right wing of the Republican Party found that out, they would have crucified Bush. They might have even defeated him for renomination.
What's another example of a deal that was made in private between Gorbachev and Bush?
Another example is the early days of the Gulf War. George Bush was very eager to get the Soviet Union to be part of that 26-nation coalition that was part of Desert Storm. As we show in the book, Bush paid a very high price for that. One of the parts of that price was he promised Gorbachev secretly that Gorbachev and the Soviet Union would have a powerful role in the post-Gulf War Middle East. He also promised Gorbachev that he would help to sponsor the Middle East peace talks that are still going on today. Bush did all of that in secret, but at the time he was asked again and again, was there any linkage between Soviet support on the Gulf War and these things? Bush always said no.
With Gorbachev out of office, what's happened to that deal?
That deal is being carried on by the American side, not because Bill Clinton is bound by any promises that George Bush made in secret, but because he thinks that it is the right policy to carry on those negotiations.
Well, during the Gulf War, Ambassador Alexander Bresmertnik talked to Secretary of State James Baker. And this was just hours before the bombing was scheduled to begin, and Bresmertnik begged Baker to hold off the bombing by 24 hours. Baker told him no, that it was too late to change the plans, but why was Bresmertnik so determined to postpone the bombing?
The Russians were playing a double game by January of 1991, and this was a case in which Gorbachev was in certain ways exploiting his relationship with George Bush. He would say to Bush, you know, I'm with you, we're all for defeating Saddam Hussein, and at the same time, as we show in the book, secretly, Gorbachev and the Soviets were trying to sidle up to Saddam, do certain things for him in order to preserve Soviet influence in the post-war Middle East. And so therefore, Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker, had to deal with this rather odd sort of double-sided diplomacy, and that accounts for a lot of the duplicity that you see during that period.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Beschloss, co-author of the new book, At the Highest Levels, The Inside Story of the End of the Cold War. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with historian Michael Beschloss. In addition to his new book about the end of the Cold War, he's also the author of a book called The Crisis Years about Kennedy and Khrushchev. At the end of the Cold War, this is in January 1982, President Bush made a State of the Union address, and in it he talked about how we won the Cold War. Now, the Soviet Union had already split up. Gorbachev was already out of office. This was obviously not the language Bush had used in his conversations with Gorbachev about the end of the Cold War. Do you know anything about what happened behind the scenes in that kind of "we won" spin? How Bush started using it and how Gorbachev reacted to it?
When Bush in January 92, for the first time in public, said the U.S. has won the Cold War, that was very deliberate. We found that when Bush met with Gorbachev in secret at Malta in December of 1989, it was a month after the Berlin Wall came down, Eastern Europe was being liberated. Bush had this secret conversation with Gorbachev in which he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, I thank you for letting the Berlin Wall come down and for the Eastern European satellites coming out of your orbit, and I will make you a deal. As long as you continue this process, I will not exploit your difficulties. I will not give any Cold War victory speeches that might embarrass you in Moscow." One result of this was that George Bush turned down suggestions from his advisors that the second the Berlin Wall came down, that he fly to Berlin and declare this a great victory for the West. He could have gotten a lot of political mileage out of it. In keeping with this deal that he made in secret with Gorbachev, Bush never once flew to Berlin during the entire next 2 years of the end of the Cold War. Only in January of 1992, when the Soviet Union was dead, Gorbachev was out of office, the Cold War was over, did George Bush go before Congress and say, "We won." He said "we won" because at that point he was much more concerned about getting political capital out of his 3 years of leadership in ending the Cold War than he was in worrying about Gorbachev's sensitivities.
Have you spoken to Gorbachev since then and asked him what he thinks about this "we won" interpretation?
Between the two of us, myself and Strobe Talbot, we saw Gorbachev 4 times, and on the final time, what Gorbachev said, and this was after he was out of power, was that he was very upset by this turn in George Bush's behavior. He felt that George Bush had been gentlemanly during the previous 3 years in refraining in public from taking credit for ending the Cold War, but he couldn't understand why his old friend George was now rubbing Gorbachev's nose in his defeat.
When you look at the end of the Cold War, do you think that either Bush or Gorbachev should take more credit than the other?
The person who was responsible for the end of the Cold War more than anyone else was Mikhail Gorbachev. In 1985, if another leader had been chosen leader of the Soviet Union, let's say a neo-Leonid Brezhnev or a neo-Yuri Andropov, it is very likely that that person might have said, "The Soviet economy is faltering and we have other problems, but let's tough it out. We Soviets have advantages that the West does not have. We have a stronger will. We have a police state. If we have uprisings in Armenia or Romania, we can send in tanks and preserve our system. That's something that the West will not do." If that all had happened, I would argue that the Cold War probably would have gone on perhaps another 20 or 30 years. Therefore, for George Bush to take credit for ending the Cold War is ridiculous. At the same time, however, you have to look back over the entire half century of the Cold War and say that every one of the presidents of the United States made a distinctive contribution. The contribution of George Bush over 3 years was he made a lot of secret deals with Mikhail Gorbachev that made the end of the Cold War happen faster and more on American terms.
Do you agree with George Bush that America won the Cold War?
America won the Cold War in terms of prevailing over the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union no longer exists. But, you know, Bush's argument that the end of the Cold War and what happened at the end of 91 was in line with what he had always wanted was a little bit of an absurd argument. What Strobe Talbot and I found in researching this book was that privately in the West Wing of the White House, Bush over and over again told his aides, "We want the Soviet Union to survive intact. We don't want these 15 republics to break up with nuclear weapons spread all over the place." Bush also preferred Mikhail Gorbachev to Boris Yeltsin. So at the end of 1991, when Yeltsin replaced Gorbachev and the Soviet Union was split up into 15 republics, that was very much against what Bush had been privately working for.
After Bush was elected president, what did Gorbachev say to him in private to convince Bush that Gorbachev was for real when it came to reform, that it wasn't just a PR display?
He said a lot of reassuring things to Bush, but the one thing that had more impact than anything else was in the fall of 1989. When Gorbachev let the Berlin Wall open and let the satellites of Eastern Europe fly out of his orbit, there was no one who could argue that Gorbachev was not for real. That really opened the way for the very close relationship between Washington and Moscow during the next 2 years.
When Bush decided that Gorbachev was for real, did he restructure American policy to help Gorbachev stay in power?
Privately, Bush wanted Gorbachev in power. He was a mild reformer. He was much more agreeable to Bush than someone like Boris Yeltsin, whom Bush saw as a revolutionary with bad manners. Bush did not like Yeltsin very much. So Bush, at least in terms of rhetoric, oriented American policy around helping Gorbachev and helping reform. At the same time, we found that in private, when Bush and Baker talked to each other, what they said was, "We assume that Gorbachev is going to be deposed at some point by a hardline coup, that this period will give way to another period of Cold War and a very hardline Soviet Union. So let's lock in as many agreements that are favorable to the United States as we can, in the expectation that when Gorbachev falls, when he's replaced by some kind of a dictator, that we will have exploited this period as much as possible."
So which agreements do you think benefited by that sense of we've got to do it now?
The thing that Bush and Baker pushed most for was arms control. They expected that this period would give way to a very cold new period, and therefore they felt that the most that they could do for their country was to reduce the number of active nuclear weapons and delivery systems in the Soviet Union as much as possible.
You know, earlier you were talking about how President Bush would use Cold War rhetoric in public and then in private say to Gorbachev, "Listen, I've got to say this in public for political reasons, but you and I can, you know, talk more openly." Do you think Gorbachev did anything similar to prevent attacks from his hardliners before the coup?
I am sure he did. And one very interesting period is the early period of 1991 before that hardline coup against Gorbachev. In public, Gorbachev did a lot of terrible things, said a lot of terrible things. He tolerated the crackdown on Lithuania on Bloody Sunday in January of 1991. He also appointed a lot of hardliners to very powerful positions in that government, many of whom were part of that hardline coup in August of that year. In private, Gorbachev kept on telling Bush on the telephone and through intermediaries such as Richard Nixon, "This is only a detour. I have to do these things for domestic reasons. I haven't changed my commitment to reform."
When the Soviet people had lost confidence in Gorbachev, did Bush try to do anything to bolster Gorbachev's image?
Bush, at the end, behaved very badly in 1991. By the beginning of 1991, it was clear to pretty much everyone that the leader inside the Soviet Union who was most in line with U.S. values was not Mikhail Gorbachev, it was Boris Yeltsin. Bush, throughout these entire 3 years, had behaved atrociously toward Yeltsin. The first time Yeltsin came to the White House in September of 1989, Bush forced Yeltsin to be brought in through a side entrance. He refused to see him in the Oval Office. He had him meet with his security advisor, Brent Scowcroft. Bush condescended to drop by to see Yeltsin for 10 minutes or so. Yeltsin never forgot this. Even throughout 1991, when Yeltsin was very much more in the American interest to support, Bush, because of this personal relationship with Gorbachev, kept on trying to prop Gorbachev up, even after the hardline coup, when Gorbachev came back from house arrest in his summer home in the Crimea, came back to Moscow and said, "I still think that the Communist Party can rule Russia." Even then, Bush was not willing to relinquish this relationship with Gorbachev.
How much did the Bush administration know about the coup? You actually quote an April 91 CIA memo to Bush.
We found that throughout 1991, Bush kept on getting more and more signals that a hardline coup against Gorbachev was imminent. One of the stories that we tell in the book was that when Richard Nixon went to Moscow in April of 1991, the head of the KGB told him, "You should expect that Gorbachev will be pushed aside in favor of a more orthodox regime. You shouldn't worry about that." He hoped that Nixon would get that message back to Bush. Nixon indeed reported to Bush that he had heard that this coup was imminent. Bush got a lot of other signals, which he transmitted to Gorbachev. There was one conversation on the telephone between Bush and Gorbachev in June of 1991, in which Bush said, "We have very firm information that a hardline coup against you is about to happen. You'd better be careful." Gorbachev completely brushed it aside. By then, he was very over-self-confident.
Your book ends with Bush and Gorbachev, as you put it, united in their repudiation by their own people. You see that as an interesting parallel, that your book ends with them both rejected by their people?
There were a lot of parallels between George Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev. In many ways, Gorbachev, during the years before he became leader of the Soviet Union, had to keep a lot of his views and commitments to himself. If he had let the other Soviet leaders know how much a reformer he was, he knew that he would never become supreme leader of the Soviet Union. In the same way, George Bush knew that if Republican leaders knew that he was not quite as conservative and hardline, especially in foreign affairs, as Ronald Reagan was, he would have a very hard time being nominated for president. Bush and Gorbachev in private, as we show in the book, would oftentimes joke about these parallels between their two situations. The ultimate irony was that during this period, Bush always tried to strengthen Gorbachev politically in his country. Gorbachev tried to strengthen Bush politically in his country. Instead, it ultimately had the opposite effect. Gorbachev seemed too reliant on his relationship with Bush, was not involved enough with Boris Yeltsin. This led to his downfall. In Bush's case, he was seen to have bet on the wrong horse, meaning Gorbachev over Yeltsin, and in the end was seen to have handled foreign policy not terrifically well. That was a factor in his defeat in 1992. The result is that George Bush in Houston, Texas, and Mikhail Gorbachev in Moscow are now both writing their memoirs, hoping finally for historical vindication.
Michael Beschloss is co-author of At the Highest Levels, The Inside Story of the End of the Cold War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Beschloss will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Now that the Cold War is over, how will historians look at George Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev? Coming up, we continue our talk with historian Michael Beschloss. He had access to private communications between the two leaders in the years leading up to the collapse of the Soviet Union. He'll also tell us how he once, and only once, delivered a secret message from Gorbachev to Bush. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the Juliet Letters, the new album by Elvis Costello, and the Brodsky Quartet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton and British Prime Minister John Major have held their first meeting since the U.S. presidential election. Major gave his support to U.S. plans to airdrop food and medicine to Bosnia, but said that his country would not take part. Major said that Britain is helping out in aid efforts on land in Bosnia. Mr. Clinton told a news conference this afternoon at the White House that it would be a mistake to look at these airdrops in eastern Bosnia as leading to a greater role in the factional fighting in the region. Prime Minister Brian Mulroney of Canada has announced that he's stepping down after 8.5 years in office. His move comes at a time when polls show that he has very little public support and just months before federal elections. Jennifer Ludden reports.
Speaking to supporters and the media today, Mulroney acknowledged the harsh criticism he's received for the strict budget cuts and higher taxes that have marked his most recent years in office. But he defended his actions, including his strong support of free trade.
Whether one agrees with our solutions or not, none will accuse us, I think, of having chosen to evade our responsibilities by sidestepping the most controversial questions of our time.
Mulroney says he'll continue his duties until a new leader of the Conservative Party is chosen, probably in June. His resignation is seen as the best chance for the Conservatives to keep their majority in Parliament and the office of Prime Minister when federal elections are held this fall. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Republican leader Bob Dole today criticized the Clinton administration's decision to delay action on its economic stimulus package until after Congress votes on spending cuts. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Dole said the administration's decision amounts to a retreat. Dole added that, "I think they're looking for cover. Why? Because they know that this package is in trouble." The Republican leader's comments came after the administration announced last night that it will support putting a budget resolution on a legislative fast track so that lawmakers can vote on spending cuts first. The administration originally had planned to push through President Clinton's stimulus package before taking up the spending cuts, but many House Democrats, freshmen in particular, whose 64 votes are crucial to the president's plan, insisted that there be significant deficit reduction first. Democratic leader George Mitchell of Maine said he hopes the Senate will take up the budget resolution in mid-March, and he criticized Republicans for not having offered their own plan for spending cuts. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
The government says that orders for durable goods were off by 1.7% last month, the biggest drop in half a year. A large reason for the fall was a decline in new aircraft orders. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 33 points to close at 3,356. This is NPR News. Appearing on Capitol Hill for the third time in less than a week, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan said this morning the outlook for the nation's economy is reasonably good. Last week, Greenspan endorsed the president's economic program, and while Republicans in the House Budget Committee tried today to get Greenspan to criticize certain parts of Mr. Clinton's proposals, the Fed chairman refused to do so. Greenspan said Congress faces tough political questions in deciding the exact makeup of spending cuts and tax increases to include in the final program. But he said these choices are up to elected officials and not the Federal Reserve. Clinton administration officials today told Congress that they're putting the finishing touches on a new set of standards for preparing high school students for work. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Education Secretary Richard Riley and Labor Secretary Robert Reich told the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee today that high schools and job training programs must adopt new world-class standards and a more rigorous curriculum to prepare young people for work. Reich said education and training in the United States today constitute the worst school-to-work transition system in the industrialized world. Riley said the new standards and a number of related proposals would be unveiled very, very soon. The proposed legislation would call for the creation of a monitoring system that would evaluate how each state was implementing the higher standards, which Riley said would not be enforced or mandated from Washington, but rather become a benchmark that parents, employers, and taxpayers can use to compare the quality of their education and training to programs around the world. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
Also in Washington, the House has approved a $5.7 billion measure to extend jobless benefits to the long-term unemployed. The measure now goes on to the Senate. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with historian Michael Beschloss, co-author of the new book At the Highest Levels, The Inside Story of the End of the Cold War. Beschloss and his co-author Strobe Talbot had access to transcripts of many secret phone calls and conversations between Bush and Gorbachev. George Bush's presidency was focused on foreign affairs. I asked Beschloss if his behind-the-scenes research into the end of the Cold War changed his perceptions of Bush's foreign policy skills.
It did. George Bush was a very good tactician, and you look at how he operated behind closed doors in many of these negotiations, and he did pretty well. But ultimately, Bush's background in foreign affairs was very superficial, very bureaucratic. He had not really been a geopolitical strategist, nor was he as president. And one thing that you really notice in looking back at Bush as a diplomatist is how ahistorical the man was. One case in point. When the Berlin Wall came down in November of 1989, the U.S. had to make a decision on how quickly we would support the unification once again of Germany. Now, an historian would want to see in a president some reference to the fact that Germany, after all, in the teens and in the 30s, had been responsible for two world wars, and that this should be some consideration when this decision was being made. Not once in any of the private conversations that Bush had influentially on the unification of Germany did he refer to history. He simply thought of Germany as a place on the map in 1989, that the German people of 1989 had no connection with those of earlier in the century. As an historian looking back on this, naturally given my line of work, I'm sorry not to see history consulted by a president, but I think it also shows how thin many of George Bush's judgments were.
What about looking at Gorbachev with the benefit of all the behind-the-scenes information that you got? Did your opinion of him change?
It did. Gorbachev is without question the major figure of the late 20th century. If he had not existed, we would probably still be in a Cold War and there would still be a Soviet Union. The thing, though, with Gorbachev is that there are so many virtues alongside defects. This is someone who had the vision in the mid-80s to say the Soviet Union is not working. We can't pursue imperial communism forever. But by 1990 and 1991, he was beginning to have certain of the deficiencies of the dictator. He wasn't taking advice. He was getting a little bit self-deluded. One example was when Bush warned him against a coup. Gorbachev brushed the warning aside, did not give it a second thought. So the fascinating thing with Gorbachev is how a great leader with many of these qualities that led to the most important accomplishment of the late 20th century could have coexisted in the same man who was, in many ways, out to lunch.
The Soviets and the Americans that you were dealing with in the research for your new book knew that you were going back and forth between the Soviets and the Americans. Did anyone try to use you as a go-between?
They did. In December of 1991, December 13th, Strobe Talbot and I interviewed Mikhail Gorbachev in the Kremlin. This was ultimately 12 days before Gorbachev resigned. The next day, we were invited to lunch by an aide to Gorbachev, who at the end of the meal asked his wife to leave the room and said he had a confidential message that he wanted Strobe, Talbot, and me to deliver to either President Bush or Secretary Baker. The message was that Gorbachev was about to resign, but he was worried about resigning because he had heard that people around his successor, Boris Yeltsin, were compiling a criminal case against him. Gorbachev was worried that a trial by Yeltsin's people might even result in his execution. Gorbachev wanted Bush to intercede with Boris Yeltsin to get assurances that if Gorbachev resigned, he would not be hounded and put on criminal trial. Talbot and I the next day took the message to Secretary Baker, who had just arrived in Moscow. Baker, when he saw Yeltsin the next day, brought this up and did get those assurances.
Now, how did you decide that you would actually deliver the message?
Well, we were a little bit torn because as authors who were writing about these matters, we felt uncomfortable getting involved in all this, but we felt that this was not something that would compromise us as independent observers. We also felt that it could be important historically. The other thing that's funny about it is you might think, why didn't Gorbachev simply use the telephone or work through the U.S. Embassy? The reason for that was that Gorbachev by then thought that Bush and his people had become so pro-Yeltsin, especially those in the embassy in Moscow, that they could not be expected to deal with a message like this impartially. So therefore, he had to rely on two American authors who were visiting Moscow. It was a very strange channel.
Were you worried that once you delivered one message, other people would want you to deliver messages for them too?
We were not, because this was 3 weeks before the end of the period that we were writing about, and when we took the message to Baker, we said that this is our single excursion into international diplomacy and that we would now remove ourselves. As it turns out, what we said was wrong, because my co-author Strobe Talbot has just been appointed the advisor to the Secretary of State on American relations with the former Soviet Union, and so therefore he is now a full-fledged diplomat rather than just an author.
How do you feel about his becoming a diplomat? You know, having worked with him on this book in his capacity as journalist.
Well, the joke that I always tell is that, and this is quite true, we are one of the rare sets of co-authors who were not only on speaking terms at the end of this very intense process of writing a book together, but even better friends than we were at the beginning, and therefore I felt that Strobe's diplomatic talents were being wasted on just me and should be shared with the whole country. It's something that he is very well suited for. This is someone who in high school studied Russian literature and Russian history in college. He was the translator and editor of Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs when he was in his early 20s. As a matter of fact, at that time, he was Bill Clinton's roommate at Oxford, and Bill Clinton would cook scrambled eggs while Strobe was working on this manuscript. Clinton later said, you know, I had this roommate who was getting ahead so far and so fast translating Khrushchev's memoirs that I knew I'd better get going in my career. I think he probably feels that he's done that in retrospect.
My guest is Michael Beschloss, and with Strobe Talbot, he's written a new book called At the Highest Levels, The Inside Story of the End of the Cold War. We're going to take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Beschloss. He's co-author with Strobe Talbot of the new book, At the Highest Levels, The Inside Story of the End of the Cold War. If you look at Reagan, Bush, and Clinton, do you see any pattern that would indicate in any ways in which the role of the President of the United States might be changing?
I think one thing that Clinton is making a very big point of is the idea that if you filter among the American people, that that puts you into closer touch with them. That's very much sort of a critique of the George Bush presidency. We heard it very much during the last campaign. I think it is not a very powerful argument. The White House would argue that Clinton's town meetings are intended largely to educate the president and keep him in touch. I think realistically, if you had to analyze it, those town meetings are perhaps 95% to advertise the president and his program, and perhaps 5% to educate Bill Clinton. It's not a criticism of him, but I think one thing that is perhaps a worrisome tendency is if he does continue to spend so much time on the road, so much time demonstrating to the public in terms of symbolism that he is one of them, that in certain respects may impede him as president.
Why?
One problem that Jimmy Carter found, for instance, in 1977 was that he spent so much time engaging in this kind of symbolism that it caused him to give short shrift to others of the duties of the President of the United States. And by the end of 1977, you very rarely saw Carter getting off an airplane with the garment bag over his shoulder. They even started playing Hail to the Chief again, which they had stopped doing during Carter's first year. My guess is that Clinton, in a considerable way, is reflecting the experience of a very successful 1992 campaign. My guess would be that 2 years from now we will see much less of this.
Your previous books have been about American presidents, but they've been about dead American presidents. You've been writing history. This new book is about Bush and Gorbachev, two figures who are now out of office but are still alive. They were in office when you were writing about them. So this new book is a different kind of history. It's current history. Was the process of writing it very different for you?
Very different. This book straddles the line between current events and history. We historians would say that you really need 30 or 40 years to write a book that is real history. That's because it takes that long for documents to come out and also for you to have enough hindsight that you can really draw definitive judgments. For instance, if Boris Yeltsin were to be deposed tomorrow by a neo-communist regime in Moscow, that would completely change a lot of the judgments that one would draw about the last 3 years of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
What Talbot and I try to do with this book was to get as much information onto the public record as might be the case were we writing 20 or 30 years from now, but we have been somewhat tentative in our judgments because we know those depend so much on what happens in the next 20 or 30 years, how the story finally turns out.
Let me ask you for one quick judgment before we have to let you go, and that is what you think of Boris Yeltsin.
I think Boris Yeltsin is a hero to the Russian people. If he were not present during the hardline coup of August 1991, that coup might very well have succeeded. We might be in a great new period of Cold War. Boris Yeltsin was very courageous throughout 1992. He had promised to institute reforms that would be very damaging to him politically, and he put them through. Economic shock therapy, which resulted in a 2,600% inflation rate within the former Soviet Union, within Russia, which has made him very unpopular. The one thing that influences all of this is the position of the United States. George Bush, at the time Yeltsin came in, made Yeltsin a lot of promises. He said, "Boris, if you take these risks, the United States will stand with you." Well, during 1992, George Bush was very much absorbed in domestic politics. He knew Americans didn't care much about foreign affairs. He knew they weren't very eager to spend money on foreign aid, and he really dropped the ball. The fascinating thing to see will be during the next 3 or 4 months whether Bill Clinton picks up the ball that was dropped by George Bush, whether he is able to say to the American people, "You may not want to spend several billion dollars for the former Soviet Union, but that is a much better investment now than to take the risk that we may be dealing with a hostile government in Moscow in the future that's going to cost a lot more in defense spending."
Michael Beschloss, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Michael Beschloss is co-author of the new book, At the Highest Levels, The Inside Story of the End of the Cold War. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we have a report from Deborah Wong today about Bombay and what's happened in India's second largest city since the riots in December that were touched off by Hindu nationalists destroying a mosque in India. Also, news of the resignation of Canada's Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney, and of today's hearings on Capitol Hill on the energy tax proposal of the Clinton administration. Speculation about what sorts of new taxes might be created to pay for health care reform. Those stories coming up.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Pop singer and songwriter Elvis Costello has said he learned to read and write music when he began working on his new album, The Juliet Letters. He collaborated with a highly respected classical group, the Brodsky String Quartet. So is this a new and original concept, or just a pretentious imitation of the classics? Classical music critic Lord Schwartz reminds us that some memorable music has come from the collaboration between pop and classical musicians.
Back in the 1950s, a Frank Sinatra album called Close to You created a sensation because the songs were accompanied by one of America's greatest chamber groups, the Hollywood String Quartet. It remains one of Sinatra's warmest and most elegant albums. Or think of the Beatles. A string octet helped darken and deepen the mood of Eleanor Rigby. And in Penny Lane, David Mason of the Philharmonia Orchestra played a brilliant piccolo trumpet obbligato. It sounded like a fanfare out of Handel and energized the song in surprising ways. More recently, the Kronos String Quartet played an arrangement of Jimi Hendrix that showed how classical strings could be just as gutsy as more traditional rock instruments. But Elvis Costello's The Juliet Letters is on a whole different level of ambition. It's not merely a series of songs with a classical-style accompaniment, but a real song cycle, not a single continuous story, but a series of evocative, thematically connected songs in many different moods. Art songs, the sort of thing Schubert and Schumann did, not something you'd associate with pop music.
I'm a female soldier, my name is Constance. I enlisted in the military, needing funds for college. I'm 23 years old, and if I do get home alive, I imagine I may think again. I'm sleeping with my eyes open for fear of attack. Your words are comfort, they're the best things that I have. Apart from family pictures and of course my gas mask, I don't know why I am writing to
That's from the song that's at the heart of the album, I Thought I'd Write to Juliet. It's based on a letter that Elvis Costello received during the Gulf War. The cycle consists of a series of imaginary letters. Costello says he was inspired by something he had read about real people writing letters to Juliet Capulet in Verona. His co-writers and composers are the Brodsky String Quartet, who are especially admired for their performances of Dmitri Shostakovich's beautiful but bleak string quartets. I really like the tension between the sound of the strings and the rough sound of Elvis Costello's expressive but distinctly unclassical voice. He sings with passion and irony, something Barbara Streisand seemed afraid to do when she recorded her album of classical art songs. The Brodsky's accompaniments are rich and varied, and of course wonderfully played. This is the beginning of Romeo's Seance. Some of the songs have more melodic profile. They're more recitative than aria. Some of them sound as if they were ground out by committee, a committee heavily influenced by Kurt Weill. But I'm finally impressed by the consistent intelligence and the pervasive sense of melancholy. I find the Juliet letters a lot more moving than, say, Paul McCartney's Liverpool Oratorio, which felt more like liverwurst. More an imitation of classical music than a real intersection between classical and pop. I wish more pop artists had Elvis Costello's guts to really revitalize classical forms and open up such daring new possibilities.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the Juliet Letters, featuring Elvis Costello and the Brodsky Quartet. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Don't send any money. The fate has no price. Ignore at your peril his splendid advice. An invaluable link and an infinite chain. An offer like this will just not come again. You had women to charm and bewitch. Power of life and death over the rich. Young girls will be swooning because you're exciting them. Not only fall at your feet, but be biting them. Guaranteed, guaranteed to capture your breath or possibly scare you to death. Sign it and seal it and send it to friends. Don't mention my name, don't make any long-term plans. 36 hours, your fortunes will change. Best friends won't know you, and neither will strangers. Do not keep this letter, it must leave your hand.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the world's most respected war surgeons, Chris Yanu. He was chief of surgery in Somalia for the International Committee of the Red Cross. Before that, he was the sole surgeon in the Palestinian refugee camp of Shatila. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.